collect your hearts.
Check, check, check. Check. Can you hear me? It's good. Do you mind checking?
Check. Barbara Mayberry, check. Okay.
Okay. My name is Zach Wooten, and I am sitting here with Barbara Mayberry at Roanoke College Library on October 5th, 2016, as part of the Southwest Virginia LGBTQ History Project Oral History Initiative. Could you just start off by telling us your name and a little bit about yourself, like where you grew up and such?
Okay. My name is Barbara Mayberry. I am 55 years old and proud of it. Was born and raised in Roanoke. Lived outside of the area. Lived in Arlington, Virginia, Orlando, Florida, and Charlotte, North Carolina. Other than, did I say Arlington? Yes, I did. Other than here in Roanoke. So.
What about your parents? What were they like?
Oh, Mom and Dad. That's Helen and Duke Mayberry, because his name is Clarence. But he was raised in Salem, Virginia, Salem-born, Salem-bred kind of thing. Loved Roanoke College, by the way. I grew up here a lot, going to ball games and things. And my mom was a singer. She sang in different local area groups. My dad was a fisherman and a football official and all those kind of things. And I have one sister. Is that good? She is 10 years older than I am, so she's 65, and she's married, has one child and now, or one son and two grandchildren. So, let's see. What else?
Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood, what it was like growing up?
Childhood, I was the ultimate diva. I grew up in dance lessons for 20 years. I've always been prissy and makeup and hair and usually nails and did beauty pageants and grew up on stage. Was also daddy's tomboy. Went with him when he would go the beginning of every fall to look for deer tracks and bear tracks in the woods. And I was a Girl Scout, you know, all those kind of things. So I enjoyed that part of it. And fishing. We used to go fishing a whole lot, too. With Mom, I was the one who came in. I was a latchkey child, so I came in about 12 years old and started learning to cook dinner and washing clothes and taking care of the house because both parents worked. And very middle class. I guess that's pretty much good for them.
When did you figure out for yourself about your sexuality?
I went away to college at age 19, went to Shenandoah Conservatory of Music, now Shenandoah University. And, you know, that was 4 hours away from home, thank you, Jesus. And, you know, every teenager's dream is to be away from home. And I got to go, and I met these two women that were in, or two girls that were a couple of years older than me in school, and there was kind of a rumor going around that they were girlfriends. Well, that intrigued the heck out of me, because I'd always lived the straight life until then, but always knew I didn't want to really be around boys, and really was not a sexual thing. They were really good friends, but that was about it. And kept seeing that one of the girls, and she ended up being my girlfriend for 7 years. It was my first relationship, yeah. And her name was Michelle, and that was my very first relationship. She happened to kiss me one night, and the thoughts that went through my mind were, oh my God, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? What do you do? Kiss her back? Do you not? Do you kiss her back? And then finally I kissed her, and there began the journey of my life.
So that's obviously your first homosexual sexual mm-hmm. experience. Did you have any sexual experiences before that? No, heterosexual?
Yes. I dated boys. Like I said, they were, you know, better friends, And I thought I was in love a couple of times and realized that's not really what it was. I just wanted to hang around with my girlfriends and go dancing. And, you know, if we met somebody at the bars and danced and stuff, that was fine. It was not a big thing for me to date. I really never had long-term male-female relationships.
What were the reactions of your parents and your peers when you came out? Were they encouraging?
Well, once I came home after a year of college and had all my stuff brought back. It was downstairs in the basement. And my mother went through my trunk and found my love letters to Michelle. And evidently she and my father had had a little tete-a-tete and talked about each other and talked about this. And I can remember sitting on a Florida room, and we were sitting there. My dad called me out there and decided that he was going to throw these letters at me and ask me what they were about. And he did, and I remember him calling me a lesbian, a dyke, a fag, a queer, everything, every negative connotation that went around homosexuality. I was raised a good Southern Baptist girl, so that was one of those things you just didn't really do. You know, you didn't have any homosexual thoughts, and they'd always thought that I was just going to be, you know, fabulous and straight. My mother used to always tell me, find a man with good insurance, and I didn't do that. So, yeah, it was bad. They sent me to, well, they called my doctor that I'd gone to my whole life, and that, which totally embarrassed me. I mean, here my doctor Berthoff knew that I was gay, for God's sakes. And they asked him about counseling, and he said, well, I'll pick out a couple, and will she want a male or female? So they asked me, and, you know, they sat there, and I was just devastated. My mother hardly said a word and really wouldn't look at me during this whole talk. My father enjoyed sitting, I don't know they enjoyed it, but to me it felt like he was, you know, badgering me about this. And so I went to the counselor, and all I remember is this. We were in this really long room, and she had hugely long legs, just to me, and she wore a dress, and that's all I remember. I don't even know that I looked at her face. You know, I was just like, gosh, her legs are so long kind of deal, you know, trying to take my mind off what was going on. And so we talked. I went like 3 sessions to her, and then she wanted to have a session with my mom, my dad, and my sister. Well, I was not real happy about that because I was like, no matter how you look at it, that's 3 against 1. And she kept saying, well, Barbara, but this isn't your issue. This is their issue. You seem comfortable with who you are and you don't have any questions. It's your parents who are not comfortable with the situation and who you are. And I was like, okay, all right, we'll do it. So the day that we had the appointment scheduled for all of us to meet, I got up that morning and packed my car and went back to Winchester to be with my girlfriend because I said, I ain't going through this at all. I'm going. This is not going to happen. And I'm not going to be back to the corner. You know, this just wasn't going to be it. And they went ahead and had the meeting because I talked to my sister about it. And she said, yes, we had the meeting. And she told us that you knew who you were. And, you know, it seemed to be mom and daddy's problem. And my father said, well, she's not welcome back in the house. And especially typically in the early 80s, that's a lot of what we heard. Anybody that came out. I don't care whether you're male or female. And so that's what I went through with them, needless to say. And then with my friends, I didn't really tell very many people here because, you know, they all still were everything was so closeted then and so taboo that if you mentioned it, you know, you were, I'm sure all my girlfriends have been like, well, she slept in the bed with me. Did she ever, you know, think about me? No, 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 no. And one of my very best friends, who I finally ended up telling a few years later, said, why did you not tell me? And I said, well, and I explained that whole scenario. You know, don't you, you know, I just wondered how you were going to react to it. And she said, Well, did you ever have feelings for me? And I said, no. I said, I really don't think I did. And she said, why not? And then, you know, then you're like, oh, no, not the typical straight lady, you know, questions. Why didn't you have feelings for me? What was wrong with me kind of deal? But I finally did tell people. And then after that, I think after I came out to Linda, made it easier for me to come out to everybody else. And by that point, then I was proud and gay and lesbian and, you know, I wanted everybody to know at that point, so.
You talk about the 80s, and I assume that you went to college during that time.
Yes.
What was your college experience like, aside from, you know, your girlfriends?
Well, started at Western, did a year at Western, so 18 to 19 I was there, and then 19 to 20 I went to Shenandoah. I loved college because I was a theater major, so I thought that was like the grandest thing in the world. I was on stage yet again in my life and felt at home, and there were more gay males up there than I was around. Then when I would come home, and even in high school, and I neglected to mention this, my 18 year, I used to go to First Baptist Church downtown, and I would leave church on Sunday night and go down to the park and dance and watch the drag show, because I thought the drag shows were the best thing ever, 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 and that, you know, I felt right at home there. And I had a lot of lesbian girlfriends who were like, well, you know, what kind of woman do you like? And I'm like, well, I don't like women. This was before Michelle, so, you know, that's not going to happen. I just like to come down here and dance, you know. And I was gay curious. I know I was. And so I was already at home with homosexuals, but mostly males. And so this female thing was kind of it was almost like a challenge in order to get her to kiss me in the first place. Because, I mean, if she didn't know, I was pure puppy dog to her. I mean, I just looked at her like, oh, you got the most beautiful voice, and you're so pretty. And I know she just was like, God, you were just all up in my stuff. Back off some. But she kissed me, so. But the 80s were, it was an interesting time for everybody, you know, because that's when, at the bars and things, that's when drugs came in. Cocaine was really big, and poppers. Everybody did poppers. You know, it's called VHS head cleaner. It was a little bottle about this big, and you would put your finger over it, and you would, amyl nitrate is what it was, amyl nitrate. And you would sniff this into your lungs, and it's like euphoric. You had this really euphoric feeling, and you felt the music, and you danced. I mean, everybody, and they would pass it around on the floor, one person to the next, to the next, to the next. And it didn't matter who handed it to you, you just did it. And so I do remember that was part of that whole phase of my life, was being, it was so freeing. And then the name amyl nitrate only made it more freeing. But then I realized after a while that was probably turning my brain to plastic and was probably doing damage to my septum. So I stopped doing that. I'm pretty good about, you know, I may try something, but then, no, I don't like it. I've never been habitual with stuff. So, but in that time, especially in Roanoke, that was a big part of Roanoke, and a big part of the bar life. So,
The 80s were an important time in terms of the fight for gay rights. Were you a part of that movement, or is there anything to say about that?
Yeah, because when I came home, I got involved with Pride. Like I said, that's when I was like the proudest lesbian in Roanoke, especially when I came back and told all those lesbian friends of mine that I used to say, no, 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 guess what? I got a girlfriend. They're like, well, we could have told you that. You know, I guess they had gaydar at that time and thought that I was a big lesbian. So I think the saddest part of that time period was, like I said, the reaction that parents treated their children. And it was so easy to turn your back on your child. And heartbreaking now for me to look back at it and think that my father would even say those things to me, and that my mother, who was my, to me, my whole life was the right hand of God, would not even defend me, you know. And so I knew this was going on with other people because I wasn't the only one in the world going through it. And then I would hear, we had so many suicides, you know. I know suicide is, especially amongst the LGBTQA or Q population, is so prevalent now, but then it was as well. And not only that, but you, gay bashings, before gay bashing was given a term, it was hugely part of a way of life. I mean, you had to, there were people that got shot outside the bar. One of my ex-girlfriends stood there and got shot with BB guns. They were all standing in line. There was a time when you had to stand in line outside the park to get in. And I mean, it would take 20, 30 minutes to get in. There were so many people in line to get in that bar. And I mean, it was really obviously dangerous once I heard that, you know, that Darlene had gotten shot with a BB gun. And then one night following church, my preacher's son and the assistant preacher's son came down and stood outside the park and was screaming. And I think that's because they had heard that I was down there and I was such a big part of the youth group that they wanted to see if I was down there. And they stood out front and called everybody fags and dykes and queers and you're going to hell, all of that type situation. And I mean, so you're even getting that from your peers, let alone an older generation. And it was a very scary time in the 80s because it was on that edge of the sword where it was, you know, more people were coming out, but you were scared to come out because of the of how society perceived you.
So, speaking of gay bars, there's a rumor that you once were running a gay bar.
Yes, I went into that aspect of it, and it was called The Alternative. It was, I don't know that I looked into it because it was a $10,000 a month rent, but everything was in there. I mean, you walked in, the lights were there, the music system was there, the kitchen was there, the dishes were there, the forks were there, the papers were there, pens were there. Everything was there. We just had to walk in and kind of take what used to be a country line dancing bar that was on the Country Channel. It was CMT carried Roanoke, Virginia, and it was called Valley Country. And I mean, it's a huge warehouse. The park, the whole upstairs of the park was the size of my dance floor. So that tells you, I mean, even back to the dressing rooms, the whole size of the upstairs of the park was my dance floor. And I had a person that was involved at the time as my show director, who was into drug activity, goes back to the cocaine aspect then, and I had to make a decision one night when I watched people go in there and all my staff was looking at me like, well, what are you going to do? And I'd already been to the owner of the building and said, will you help me? And he didn't help me, so I closed the doors and went home. And that's all I could do. I mean, it was either that or somebody's going to come in. I was going to get busted. The cops were going to come, ABC, something. And I was not going down. This was not Barbara's life. This was his life. And so I had to make a decision about that. But owning a bar was fabulous. That was especially during the 80s. It was fabulous. Well, early 90s, it was fabulous. It was 1991 is when I had it.
While it was open, was it, you know, secretive underground gay bar?
No, at that point we had, because by then we were into, like I said, into the 90s. And things had changed in Roanoke. Pride was more visible. More straight couples were coming to the bar, excuse me, to the park as well as to my bar. I mean, it had become the cool thing to do, to hang around with the gays, you know, because they had the fun life. They did the drag shows, and they had the best dance music, and we were always getting new DJs in to, you know, make sure that we kept the music fresh and, excuse me, and so it wasn't as closeted as it was in the 80s. Just in one decade shows you how it went from completely secretive to, hey, bring your friends. Now, let's have a bridal party down there. You know, they'd bring all the brides. The bride would come and all her people. The groom would come and all his people. And I mean, it was just, it was a bit of a, what's the word I want to use? Oddity. And they enjoyed coming down there and being able to say, oh yeah, I go to the park or I go to the alternative and dance. So, yeah, I think things became more accepting in the 90s, right there, especially that crossover from the 80s to the 90s. So,
so you're the vice chair of the PRISM Foundation, mm-hmm. that's based in Roanoke. Can you tell me a little bit about that organization and what they've accomplished in the area?
Okay. We've only been in existence for... I don't even think it's been quite a year yet. What we're doing is we were established from Roanoke Pride to work with Greater Roanoke Valley and Southwest Virginia youth who have been displaced or are homeless, kids who want to become more involved in the gay community, but not in a teenage base, not specifically like going to the bar or that kind of thing, but trying to give, to be a role model to kids who need that, or sometimes we turn out to be maternal or paternal figures to a lot of the kids, because, you know, they were kicked out of their home, or they, and it's a sad thing. You know, I just talked about this whole lineage, and in a two-decade time period, we went from the same thing to what we're going through again. Parents have not moved forward that much. Society, the greater part of society does, but I think it's got to be the biggest shock for your parents to know, oh, you're a what? Oh, a lesbian, or you're a gay man, or you're transgender. Or bisexual. You know, I just think it's such a flip out for parents. And that's what we're trying to do, is establish a situation where it's a safe haven, where we can do job training. We work with TAP, and we work with what used to be Trust House, and now it's under a different acronym, and I can't remember what it's called now. But Trust House will help with placing for housing, and TAP works with job training. So we have now established a collaborative effort, and we just had a meet and greet for all of the nonprofit organizations, where they came in and they got to hear what we were here for. You know, here's what we can offer you. You in turn help us by directing your GLBT youth to come this way, you know, to come over to us, and that we can help them. And then in turn, we're going to tell you you can help us. We need you to do be supportive, volunteer work, aspects about doing workshops, and I mean, there's so much there. And we also just established two scholarships. One is the Pride Leadership Scholarship, and one is the Helen Mayberry Scholarship, which is what we call Miss Helen's Helping Hands, because my mother, during my adult years, became like the mother to all the gays. I mean, I had boys come in the house, I dressed them in drag, and they went out as girls. My mother would have to have them come in, oh, let me see what you're wearing. And she did sewing for them, you know, here, let me tack this for you, or put on a zipper or whatever. And then she saw girls come in, and they all lived as boys. So my mom became, from that woman who sat across the room from me originally and wouldn't even look me in the eye and was so heartbroken that her daughter was a lesbian, now was one of my biggest supporters. My dad, when I had the bar, he had had strokes, and by that point, some of his masculinity, he wasn't on guard all the time, and this was an embarrassment to him. He would hold dollar bills up and shake up, come here, to all the drag queens, and he loved all the drag queens. He had so much fun. It's really amazing what my parents, who were in their 50s, well, let's see, I was 20, my mom was in her 40s, so... she was in her 50s. So 50s and 60s and 70s even, being my biggest supporters. You know, my mom and dad backed me on the bar. And so, you know, it's just nice to see that if I can give this kind of a guidance to the parents working with PRISM or even just talking to people like PFLAG, where we can go and do workshops with them or through the church or whatever, you know, whoever wants us to come in, we can be a positive role model. And I think my mother, funny, and my dad, who were my worst nightmare at first, became my biggest supporters, and that's what I want to do. That's what I want to be to kids, and that's why I got involved with PRISM. We will be giving out the two scholarships this fall, should be soon, so that most people probably use it for next semester. But, you know, the really cool thing is that there's so many possibilities of what we can do. There's a new personal safety group that just opened up here in Salem, as a matter of fact, and I saw that they had just opened, and I thought, okay, here you go. I'm a marketer. I don't care whether I was a hairstylist or whatever I did in my life. I think marketing. That's the way I look at it. And so I thought, okay. So I called this person up. I said, would you ever be interested in working with the GLBT youth? And he said, well, sure. Okay. And I said, and here's what we can do. I'll get you advertisement, free advertisement. I'll get television coverage. And I'll get newspaper coverage if you will do a program for these kids. And he said, we'll do it. I said, you give me 6 months to write it a year, and I promise you I will get the kids if you'll do the program. And he said, sure, you know, because we can use all the advertisement we can get. So, I mean, there's so many different programs that we can offer to kids and so many different things that our community as a whole can give back. And to me, that's part of it. I want to teach these kids, if you want something, you better be darn well ready to give back. And at the same time, you're getting. Because I think that's probably one of the most important lessons I learned. You know, don't ask for something unless you're willing to do something for it. Nothing comes free in this world. But in the same respect, you should want to do something for somebody else because they did something for you. PRISM is going to be a great foundation for making some changes in that aspect. We just had one of our people on our board. He's a young man, and he's just decided he's going to go to Richmond and start a new life. So now we're going to be looking for a couple more people to put on the PRISM board. And so right now we're looking at filling these positions so we can get things going. We're also going to become a nonprofit status. So we'll eventually not be an entity run it by, we'll be a separate entity. And the lady that works for TAP, Jo Nelson, is also works. She's one of the co-chairs and or vice chairs, and she will help with job training, and she's a very vital part of this because she's also a social worker. So it's just maybe taking the kids to look at higher education, because I think that's a major thing. These kids, you know, they think, I don't have any family, how am I going to go to college? And I think that's part of what we're going to be there for, too. That's why we established the scholarships. That was my first thing. I want a scholarship. You know, I'd like, please name it after my mom, for the simple fact that she had an open door policy. I mean, I've had more gay people live at my house than you could shake a stick at. I really have. At one time, I had like four of my gay male friends living in the basement and in our den, and it was because they didn't have anywhere to go. And my mom was like, well, now you can't, I'm going to fix dinner, and you all just go on downstairs, and Barbara get them some sheets and blankets and stuff. I mean, she couldn't see anybody ever be in a situation. And so, you know, that's just where my foundation comes from, with wanting to be involved with PRISM and not just with Pride, because I still work with Pride, too. I mean, I still do... I'm involved with doing the events and the festival, and I've been on television, and I've been interviewed 40,000 times, and you know, so it's just, they know me. I mean, a lot of Brunette knows me, and a lot of the politicians know me because I make sure that I go up, you know, it's part of my marketing. How you doing? My name is Barbara Mayberry. How you doing? We'd like to know how you're going to be working with the LGBT community. And they're like, whoa, like Sam Russell. I love him, and he's been a very big supporter of our community, and we're very lucky to have him, and that's how I got him. I just flat out asked him, what are you going to do for me? What are you going to do for our community? And he's been so helpful, and I think, and he told me, he said, well, you put me on a spot, you know, what am I supposed to do? I have to answer to your questions, you're a constituent. And I said, that's right. And that's part of why PRISM is, I mean, we can't be politically motivated once you become a nonprofit. However, before that time period, I'm going to grab everybody I can. John Edwards, he's been very vital for us. And the local mayor has not been so forthcoming, and I can understand he's new, and he doesn't want to, you know, and he's very church-based, and he doesn't want to, really, I guess, come out too much as an advocate for the LGBT community, but we're going to get him to watch.
So other than PRISM, is there any other, you know, organizations that you've been involved with around Roanoke?
Yes. Sorry. I worked with, now it's the Drop-In Center. I used to be, I've worked for the Western Virginia AIDS Council is what it was called originally. And, I think things changed in the early 20s, and they established like a new foundation for their organization. I'm sorry. I thought I turned all this off. And they did health education. I went to prisons. I went to high schools. I went to colleges. Talked to churches. And it was always about sex, condoms, safer sex, STDs. So I was the original condom lady. Yeah, I would go around the bars and do outreach and hand out safer sex packets, and that's how they knew me. Here comes the condom lady. And so I worked with them. That was in the 90s as well. And then in the mid 80s, mid to late 80s, I was the executive director for one of the aid service. We established an aid service organization. At the time, Ryan White and the Western Virginia AIDS Council was the only thing that anybody who was HIV positive could tap or and could utilize as an organization. And we were called Sisters in the Name of Love because a bunch of drag queens started it because they knew if they could do fundraising, then we could provide funds for people who needed it. Food, clothing, housing stipends, whatever it was. And then we were active for about 5 years, became a nonprofit organization. And then in the right at the beginning of the 90s is when Ryan White got more funding, and they really didn't need our organization anymore. They had the infectious disease clinic at Carilion, so things changed with that aspect of it. I used to be the choir director for Metropolitan Community Church for 3 years. I don't know how to turn. Oh, there you go. Thank you. See, I don't know anything about it. It's a phone. I don't know. let's see. I think that's, as far as the organizations here in Roanoke, I believe that's about it on those.
So, you're married.
I am.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your partner mm-hmm. and you have a child?
Yes.
So,
Terry is my wife. We met 16 years ago, and she's 16 and a half years younger than I am. And we were together 12 years, and we decided it was right after the first wave of the legalization of gay marriage came out. D.C. was a location. Virginia hadn't even and weren't going to recognize what the United States was trying to do for the rest of the states. So Terry and I went to D.C. We figured, here comes 12, 12, 12. Maybe we ought to get married since we've been together for 12 years. And we got married in D.C., wonderful guy who married us, Wes Jamison. He is a minister for a church in Maryland, and we were his first official gay couple that he married. It was legal after the law became legal, so we take great pride in that. Then in 2014. I lost my dad in 96, so Terry and I still live with my mom, so I could take care of her because she was in failing health throughout those years. And she, about 2014, had first stroke and some major health issues, and Alzheimer's was becoming very prevalent. So that was another reason why we stayed with her. She was in the hospital, and Terry and I were talking about having a baby because we went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "You're aging out there, Terry, if you don't start doing something soon." Because they kind of looked at me, and I was like, I had a hysterectomy at 38. That's not going to be part. This one can't do that. So they talked to Terry, and explained what the risks were, what we could do while she was, let's see, she's 36. She was 36 when she had him. My mom was in the hospital, and we'd already kind of discussed all this. It probably wasn't the opportune time to be having a baby while my mom was at this point in her life. But I talked to a friend of mine, and he's a gay man, and, we were talking about looking for a donor. And so I, of course, being the researcher that I am, I went out and I was researching every aspect of how we were going to do this without going to a sperm bank and spending hugely big bucks on going to an infertility or a fertility doctor. And so I found what we were going to have to do. And so I happened to talk to my friend Dewey, and I said, "You never thought about becoming a dad, did you?" And he said, "What?" So I explained what we wanted. We don't want any financial obligations. We are not wanting to share custody. We're just wanting, you know, we just need your sperm. And he started laughing. He goes, "Well, Barbara, I'd do anything to make you happy." And I thought, God, that's like, that sentence will last in my mind the rest of my life. You know, that one statement. And so then it became kind of a joke, because then we were like, okay, well, now we got to go through ovulation testing, and we had to, you know, do all that kind of thing. And they said, when your LH surge is up is when it's, you know, that's when it's best to do it. So the morning of, there was the LH surge up, and I was like, Dewey, we got to do this today. Now, what are we going to do? Now I'm flipping out. I lost my cool at that point, because now I'm going, it's got to happen right this minute, you know? And how are we going to, we come to your house, or you come to our house, or whatever. And needless to say, he brought his deposit over to my home, and then he said, "Okay, well, I'm going to see y'all later, and you be good, and good luck, and here we go." So we tried in October. Funny, this is our anniversary month for that. And we tried once on the 13th and again on the 15th and got pregnant, we believe, the very first time. And which was a whole funny thing, because my wife watched, while I inseminated her at home, she watched the Redskin football game. Television. I flip your legs over your head, and here we go. And she said, "Can I watch the game?" I said, "I don't care if you watch CNN. You do what you want to watch. And just keep your legs over your head," because that's what I'd heard. That's kind of like a surefire way of making sure, you know, everything went in the right direction. And then we found out afterwards, it doesn't matter if you put your legs over your head or not. Sperm swims upstream. But we got pregnant, and she came to the hospital. One morning, she was taking me down to the hospital to be with my mom, and it was before we knew, and I said, "God, I have the funniest feeling today. I just feel like, I don't know, like my stomach is in knots and it's shaking." And she said, "You know, are you worried about your mom?" I said, "No, I don't think so." And she said, "Okay." Well, she dropped me off the hospital and went home, and evidently, something went through her mind, and she goes, "I'm going to go get a pregnancy test." So she goes to the Dollar Tree, which they work. They work 100%. And so she goes to the Dollar Tree right below Fleming High School and goes down to Hardee's right below. And she's in the stall, and she's trying it. And she comes out, and there's this little girl beside her. And she walks out. She's got a pregnancy test in her hand, too. And Terry's like, "Oh my God, everybody goes to Hardee's to see if they're pregnant." You know, that was the joke. It goes along for the rest of my life. And so she goes over. She goes, "Well, can you tell me what this means?" And the girl said, "Well, let's see, honey. Mine has one line, which means no. And yours has two lines, which means yes." And Terry's like, "Huh?" You know, she didn't know what to say. So she comes down the hospital, and she's got this weird look on her face, and I'm sitting beside Mama, and she walks over and she goes, "Here." And she flips it over in front of me, and I was like, "What the hell's that?" And she said, "We're pregnant." And, you know, you're expecting it. You're hoping for it. And we never thought we'd get pregnant immediately. We thought it was going to be like, you know, a year or something. We're going to be trying. And I said, "What do you mean we're pregnant?" She said, "We're pregnant." And so then the very next thing, somebody comes in. Well, I can't even tell them, because we're like, "Oh." So the whole time the girl's like, "What is wrong with y'all?" "Nothing." "Why?" "Nothing." So we left the hospital and went up to Towers to the Dollar Tree again. I said, "We're getting two more tests." I want to make sure this is not a false positive. I just want to make sure. So we go next door to McAllister's, and we both, she does two tests, and they both came up positive. And the funny thing about that is my son's middle name is McAllister, but it wasn't because of the restaurant, it's because of his godfather's last name is McAllister, so it's just yet one of those other weirdo things in my life. And so every time we go to McAllister's to eat, we're like looking at the bathroom, because that's the place. But then Cambridge was born in 6 weeks, almost 7 weeks early. So he was supposed to be, due date was July the 9th. He was born June the 10th. So preemie, 7 pounds, 9 ounce preemie. Yeah, he's huge. He is huge. He is 2 years, 3 months, and he is like this tall. He wears 4T clothing and a size 10 shoe. So they're saying he's going to be between 6'7 and 6'9. Yeah, I'll be happy at 6'5, maybe 6'4 even, but yeah, 6'7 to 6'9. So every time I see somebody that's like ultra tall, I walk over to them like, sir, how tall are you? And well, I'm 6'7, you know, you're like, okay, and immediately I go, and what size shoe do you wear? Because, and they're looking at me like, what? You're a really nosy lady. I said, my son's supposed to be your height, and I'm just trying to figure out what size shoe he's going to wear when he gets to be your height. And so, you know, I have no filter, as you can tell, and I just ask people whatever I think. And so my son's going to be a very tall young man. His name is Cambridge McAllister Mayberry Craig. So he has this long name that we know when he goes to do Scantron sheets in first grade, and everybody else is like, Liam. And they go down L-I-A-M. He's going to be on A in Cambridge when the rest of the kids are over here already on number 10. So he's going to hate us. He's going to hate us.
So what, you know, the perception of gay marriage in society is seen as the peak of the LGBTQ community. Do you also feel that way, or do you plan to play a role in the movement going forward to, you know, push it beyond just the legalization of marriage for all?
Well, yes, and I think some of my concerns are, and I'm an ordained minister too, by the way. I know that you wouldn't know that by my vocabulary, but I did that so I can marry my, you know, people in the LGBTQ community, because there were so many religions that weren't acknowledging. And as opposed to somebody having to go to the Justice of the Peace and get married, which I think is really impersonal, and it takes part of my right away, because why should I not be able to have a minister do my wedding if he can do your straight wedding? So that was one of the main reasons I went and became ordained. And I think that with that, I want to see more. I mean, I worry about adoption. I worry about divorce. And I love, and I know this might sound a little prejudiced, but I love my gay family. I do. I love all the different people within my community. But I think because gay marriage became legal, everybody did it. Now they're all just going to do it and not thinking about what the consequences thereof there are after you do it, and divorce. I have two couples I know right now. One's been married less than 2 months. They're already getting a divorce. And the other one's been married for 4 months and they're getting a divorce. And it was a had been a lesbian couple, and one of the people within the couple is now transgendering to male, and the other couple were two gay males. And the transgender male and one of the males from the other couple are now getting together. So these marriages have dissolved, and that's That's my concern. That's my concern. I think it became so much of a status symbol for our community that people are not thinking beyond the end of their nose. You know, they can't see anything past here. And they're not looking at, do I really love you? Or are we just in love today and I love you and will you marry me? Oh, nobody's ever asked me to marry them before. So then you go get married and then a month down the road, I don't love you anymore. And I don't understand that. I guess because Terry and I have been together for 16 years, so we kind of knew we were going to be together forever anyway, so we might as well get married because we knew we wanted to have a child. And I wanted to make everything legal. I just think that, you know, for my son or my child, whoever it had been at the time. But I'm looking at what it was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for all of us. It is. But it has to be taken seriously. And I think, especially for gay males, you will date this week and then next week you find somebody else, the week after that I find somebody else, or you know, it's their relationships are very short-termed as a whole. Lesbians, I met you today, we're going to have dinner tonight, tomorrow I've got the U-Haul and I'm bringing all my stuff to your house because we're going to live together the rest of our lives. So, which as you could see from that wedding, that's not true either, because they don't last forever either. And it's sad, not that heterosexual relationships last any longer, but right now because it is still a phenomenon, everybody wants to get married, and people are not looking at what the possibilities could be in a year, 5 years. There's no plan. There's no 5-year plan. There's no 10-year plan. It's, you know, until you decide you don't want to be married to me anymore. And wait till they start going through all these divorces. That's what I said. When when gay marriage before it became legalized, it's the first thing I said to, like, all the lawyers that I know, all my friends who are the politicians, I said, don't these people, I said, that, and I'm one of these people, but don't the heterosexual people in courts and representing us in Senate and all these aspects, don't they realize how much money this is going to make them? Because gay marriage is like that, honey. They'll be getting divorced. This one will have 6 marriages by the time, in a 10-year span. So look how much money y'all will make in the court systems and for the state and paying taxes. You know, that was the one thing about Virginia that really broke my heart. I couldn't get married in the place that I was born. I could not even get married in my own state because they didn't acknowledge that I was even a human. I mean, let alone that I was, you know, a lesbian, because they didn't recognize gay life at all. And we are the Commonwealth. And, you know, and I don't care which Commonwealth you're talking about around the United States, they're all the same. And so they're a little further, they're a little more backwards than some of the other more progressive states. And, you know, why would you not want my tax money? That was my thought process. Why can't I get married here? And what is the problem? Why do you care? I don't care whether you get married, so all of you, everybody else can get married all they want. But why do you not want my money? Why do you not want my taxes as a joint wedding, you know, as a joint marriage? Why do you not want my personal property taxes, all those things? Because eventually people are going to, I really didn't think we'd ever see Virginia have legalized marriage in my lifetime, to be perfectly honest. And I thought, you know, Terry and I are going to end up having to move because I'm not going to live in a state that doesn't recognize me as a human. And so thank God, within a 2-year period, all that changed. And, you know, then we received legalized marriage around the country. But there's so much that needs to be done. There's so much education within my community. Don't just go get married because you can. You know, you want to do something, buy a dog. You know, get a house. You know, do something like that. Don't get married just to get married because you can. And I think that's my biggest factor. I see too many people divorcing already or breaking up or whatever they want to call it. And I think these two couples can still be annulled, if I'm not mistaken, because it's been such a short term, you know, the ones that I mentioned. And that's sad to me. That's just sad. I can't, that you took the time to think that you were going to get married. You took these vows. One of the couples I married. And it breaks my heart because I felt like, you know, when I talked to them, oh, yes, we're great. This is what we want. You know, we've been waiting this long. We've been dating for this long and da-da-da-da. And 2 months. 2 months, it's gone. Dissolved. So I don't know if that says something about me as an officiant or as it says just about our community in general because it's still too easy. It's just easy. And, you know, I think people should have to go through counseling before you get married. I don't care if it's a religious counseling or not. I just think that you should have to go through a little bit of connecting counseling so we can see that, you know, this is the right thing for us or no, it's not the right thing for us. And I want to see so much more change with it. I want to see, you know, that, all right, perfect example. I'm married to my wife. Our son shares my last name. But my fear is, if something happened to us, or something happened to her, say she died, what does that do for me? Because she had him. And I'm not on a birth certificate. And I'm not a legal parent. And so what's that going to do for me? So now my next aspect of what marriage means is that if you're married and you have a child together after you're married, that then you're both parents, it doesn't matter. I should be as a parent on his birth certificate. And I'm still not. And that's really sad. That's why adoption, you know, I'm thinking I have to adopt my own child. I made him, you know, but he's really not mine. And that's scary. And too many couples are going through the same problems. And that's the next aspect of where, just because we have gay marriage, we still have to have all the same aspects of what that means from straight marriage to gay marriage. And I worry about the state of Virginia recognizing that. I don't know about nationally, but as far as my wonderful Commonwealth, yeah, I do worry about that if something happens.
Well, those are all the questions we have. I want to thank you for sharing with us. You know,
bless your hearts. I've probably bing-bonged around like a what's that game where you play where you pull the thing, the ball goes up, ding, 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 ding. That's what I feel like I did. So
yeah,
I apologize.
It was great. Thank you for sharing. And
I mean, in any aspect of what I can do for my community, that's what I'm supposed to be here to do. I'm trying to make a better community for my child and for everybody else's children and for the youth of tomorrow. That's why I'm involved in PRISM. And, you know, if we all don't work together, nobody prospers. Nobody. I don't care whether you're heterosexual or whether you're a member of the LGBT and Q. And it just, you know, that's we all got to work for that. So I'm not going to stop working, and you're going to see me at Pride or anywhere else or any of Dr. Rosenthal's things.
Well, thank you.
Thank you all.